for being here today. We have a pretty full agenda. We have a couple things that we're going to work on today. We're going to continue our informational hearing on the Oregon State Hospital and get some perspectives from the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, a recovery model about what's happening in Eastern Oregon, and also some employee perspectives to hear what they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And so that will help flesh out some of our knowledge on the state hospital as we look to the future about what we're going to do to carry our system forward. We also have a couple of bills that are up as a work session for the purpose of referring them to the General Government Committee. And also, we have a very special guest today, and I wanted to have Representative Butler introduce our guest at my invitation to the committee. So, Representative Butler, maybe you'd like to go down and introduce our guest and tell us a little bit about what you're working on.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to invite Director Chin and his wife forward, as well as Stephen Tai. If you come forward, please. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Butler from Ontario, House District 60. I have the great pleasure of introducing to you today Director Robert Chin and his wife, Mrs. Chin, and their assistant, Stephen Tai. This is the Director General of the Taiwan Citizens Economic and Development Cultural Development Office for the United States here in the Northwest. And we will be hearing in our committee House Joint Memorial 8, and I'm asking the chair, at least a couple of the members have signed on to House Joint Memorial 8, which is a health memorial. It asks the Oregon Legislature, the House and the Senate, to join again, as we did in the 2003 session, to encourage the World Health Organization to recognize the efforts of Taiwan. Taiwan has more than any other nation per capita participated in the remediation health issues relative to AIDS, sexually transmitted diseases, flus of all various kinds. They have committed huge resources. This is part of their contribution to the world economy, to the world health. And the House Joint Memorial, which we will be taking up in committee, House Joint Memorial 8, basically is a statement on behalf of the state of Oregon for our trading partner, the Republic of Taiwan, democratically elected 23 million people, to participate on an equal footing with all other nations in the world, because they have certainly come forward and demonstrated their commitment, their desire to be a part of the solution and not part of the problem. So it's my great pleasure to introduce the committee to the director and his wife and his staff assistant Stephen Tai, and look forward to your participation and your active involvement as we bring forward House Joint Memorial Number 8. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you for the introduction. Thank you.
Honored us with your presence, Stephen, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
All right. Appreciate those remarks, Representative Butler, and we will schedule that that resolution as soon as we have the opportunity to do so. With that, we will take a moment here.
Are you coming back, or do you want us to do the work session?
Yeah, can you stay for 1 second for the work session? Here. Okay. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2059, and Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2059 be moved to the House Committee on General Government.
Representative Butler has moved House Bill 2059 without recommendation to the House Committee on General Government. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, House Bill 2059 is ordered to the General Government Committee. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2059, open a work session on House Bill 2061. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2061 be moved to the House Committee on General Government without recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2061 without recommendation as to its passage, and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on General Government. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing no objections, House Bill 2061 is ordered, moved to the House That was Committee on General Government. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2061. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2102. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2102 be moved without recommendation to the House Committee on General Government.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2102 to the without recommendation to the House Committee on General Government. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? House Bill 2102 is ordered moved to the House Committee on General Government. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Butler. Yeah, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2102 and excuse Representative Butler. And I guess we will come back into session as a subcommittee of the Health and Human Services Committee. And we will begin with our informational meeting on the Oregon State Hospital. And we'd invite Jonathan Ader, the co-chair of the Governor's Task Force on Mental Health, forward. And anybody Mr. Ader would like to bring forward? Just yourself. All right. We had a little business we had to conduct first.
That's fine. And I appreciate the pace at which you do it, and I will try to respect everyone's time. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the invitation to be here. I had the privilege last year of serving as co-chair of the Governor's Mental Health Task Force. I commend to you all, even in a session of much reading, the entire report. I'm going to talk to you today about some of the highlights and try to give you some perspective as to how some of the thinking about the state hospital fits into a larger picture. As you all know, I think Representative Tomei was on the task force and a major player. There were 20 people. This task force is very much a group product. This is not a staff-written report embraced by all of us coming together, but represents lots of hard work by members of the task force, of whom Bob Nickel was a member, and he provided wonderful insights and assistance to us. I also want to say, in preface to my remarks, I also have the pleasure of being on the Health Policy Commission, a tenure which started about the same time as the task force, so I was a busy boy last year. As you know, Representative Dalto, you're now on that commission, as is Representative Grinlick, and we are in that forum thinking a lot about some of the larger issues about how mental health services might fit in and be integrated with other health services, and really the importance of dealing with mental illness as a chronic condition, not unlike other chronic conditions, and developing systems of care that allow us as a society to respond to people who have various kinds of chronic conditions in ways that are effective in terms of outcome and recovery. With respect to the task force, one of the things we addressed in the beginning, before we tried to think about either analyzing the current situation or making recommendations as to what might be reasonably done, is that we had to have some sense of what the values and principles and outcomes of a sound mental health system might be. And so we spent time looking at some of the prior Oregon legislation, the existing Oregon legislation, the work of prior Oregon task forces and committees, and also the work of the President's New Freedom Commission. And we distilled from that a series of 10 or 11 values and principles which appear on page 11 of our report, and it would be inappropriate to read them all because everybody would turn off, but I want to call out at least a few of them and commend this to you, because as you think about the issues that are coming along with respect to building community services and thinking about what the state hospital should be, it's important to think about that in terms of the idea that we might have some vision of what could come out of this and what our objectives are, and that it's not just a bunch of ad hoc reforms being thrown together without any particular sense of a holistic outcome. And what the task force concluded quickly were several very important things. One is that in the current world that we live in, mental illness is treatable, and often at very low direct costs, certainly compared to what we're currently incurring as a society to deal with mental health issues and the consequences of failing to deal with it. Secondly, that recovery is possible in the sense that people can learn to, who are affected even with very serious mental illness, can often learn to manage their lives with medication and support services to be productive members of society, if not completely productive, at least not heavily burdensome members of society, and that we can achieve those results if we address those problems. And the ways to address them are not old-fashioned institutional ways, but dealing with people in communities as they present themselves, where they live, where their natural support systems are, and when they don't have adequate natural support systems, helping them build those systems. Which means that we need to invest in prevention, but even when we don't succeed with prevention, we need to be able to find and help and build the supports for people where they are. But we also recognize that mental illness is an important factor in many criminal activities, and that we have a population of people within the mental health system and at the state hospital who are dangerous to themselves and to public safety, and that we thus need to deal with public safety concerns. But even perhaps more significantly, we have a lot of people in jails and prisons who are not being effectively responded to, and who are in fact going to be released at some point. And if we don't build systems both to divert them early on and to minimize their prison time and to actually restore them to a functioning position, we are going to wind up, the result is predictable, we'll have more and more recidivism. And these are, in fact, problems that we can deal with if we approach them reasonably, systematically. A good friend of mine described the healthcare system generally, and the mental health care system in particular, as being a system that has no process engineering in it, that we don't really think about where we're trying to begin and where we're trying to end. As a result, we do a lot of wheel spinning and have a lot of inefficiencies. The task force wound up because we knew that the state doesn't have a lot more money, not with a report that says you need to spend $200 or $300 million a year more and then we'll have a perfect mental health system, but to say if we approach this and break it down into small steps and think about things that we can realistically do, many of them without much money, some of them perhaps with some seed capital, but where the repayment is likely at hand, that we can actually make things happen now. And I already commended Bob Nickel, but I want to do it again because I think he's a bureaucrat that gets that. And that makes it more plausible to imagine that we can move forward right now to achieve some of those things. I want to, in that context, talk just a few minutes about what we heard and learned and recommended with respect to the Moose Hospital. And the surprising thing, perhaps, is that the issue is really not that it's a bunch of old, decrepit buildings. That's true. But if we simply built a new building, we wouldn't actually address what the task force believes should be addressed, and where I believe there's a lot of work now going into it now, which is addressing what functions do we need to serve in a central state-operated facility to have a coherent mental health system. And when you look at the current state hospital, you'll see that actually what's going on there are a lot of different things. We have no more children or adolescents as of a few weeks ago, but we certainly have a geriatric system. We have a civil commitment system. Within the forensic ward, we have people that are there to determine whether they can assist in their defense. We have people who have been determined that they can't, but with a little bit of work, they can be restored to competency. We have people who are PSRB patients who are there for indeterminate periods of time and some for determinate periods of time. Those are actually quite different missions, and it's a little bit like we were trying to run a factory in which we were making cupcakes and sewing shirts and building furniture all in the same place without really thinking very much about how we were processing any one of those things. So when you go to a forensic ward at the hospital, we have people that are there for a matter of a few weeks, and we have people that are likely to be there for a few years who have quite different service needs, mental health capacities, and other things. So it seems to me that the real challenge that needs to be worked on, and it's not just me, I think this is the real thrust of the task force recommendations, is to back up and say, what function do we need to serve? How much of that needs to be served in one building? How much of it needs to be served in Salem? Whether it's paid for by the state, whether it's in a 500-bed facility, a 16-bed facility, those things seem to me to follow from the question of what is it that we want to be doing. I've not yet been part of the discussions with the new consultants that have been hired, and of course they come with licenses as architects, but what I understand is that there are people who essentially have been very helpful to other states in thinking about some of these programmatic issues. And what I would commend to all of you is that this is an enormously worthwhile exercise. There's a lot of intuitive sense that says it should result in a smaller hospital and more small units. You can describe them, you can call them residential facilities, you can call them community centers, you can call them satellite centers. I don't think the label is significant, but what we've learned is that lots of wonderful work in terms of helping people recover, in terms of keeping society secure when you have to, can occur in smaller facilities. I had the opportunity several weeks ago to spend some time at a facility called Arbor House, which is on, it's in northeast Portland, about 21st and Fremont. That's not quite where it is, but it's run by Cascadia. It's a locked door, secure facility. You have to pass through three doors to get into where the patients are and identify yourself, and it's inconspicuously but securely fenced. This is a facility that has one or two PSRB people and some other people that are civilly committed that need to have be in a secure facility. It's a marvelous place. It is so much more interesting and lively than visiting a ward on the state hospital. It's humane. The tenures of most of their people is a year or two, and they're able to move them through and into less secure type facilities and back into the community. And one of the great advantages of a facility like that is a great deal of the funding can come from Medicare or Medicaid, depending on the age of the persons, because they are not state institutions. So what we can do is not only achieve better results, but we can actually build facilities in which do not have to be funded entirely by the general fund at the very high end of the spectrum, but which can be, there was a, in the Oregonian's editorial, it suggested a difference of $10,000 a month to $3,000 a month. I can't independently validate that, except in order of magnitude, that's about right. So I'm going to be available for a while for questions. There are people with a lot more expertise than me. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a mental health professional. But I have worked around healthcare for a long time and have some knowledge about how the pieces fit and maybe some ability to back up and look at the big picture, which is really the opportunity that we all have right now. The crisis that we've gotten ourselves into is one that we can put Band-Aids on, or we can use it as occasion to do something really smart. And rethinking what the state hospital is about, making it an appropriate size, putting the rest of the money into communities is going to result in much, much better public health outcomes, which is what we're really all about. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Ader.
Questions?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. That's very interesting. I heard, I believe you say, that this really isn't about buildings or designing new buildings and complexes as much as it is in system engineering.
That's what I said, basically. Yes, sir.
And it seems to me, as you're talking about the facility in Portland, that it's not just about an old building here, but it's an attitude, or it's a spirit, or it's something that reigns in one facility that doesn't in another. Can that not be created in facility here, maybe in smaller units?
Sure.
Or I've been talking with DOC about ways that we can see recidivism just in the general prison population reduced by programs that really aim at restoring the person and bringing about interchange. It seems to me that's where you're heading, and whether we have an old dinosaur of a building, the interior can change, and the people and the spirit that live within that building can change. It doesn't have to be 750 people. It might be 10 units of 75 people, but being handled on a very personal basis. Is that kind of the direction that you see us going?
Can I answer that in two or three different ways? But I don't want to get ahead of the architectural stuff. I'm not even part of that task force, although they have asked to talk with me a little bit. But I could imagine an outcome that says you have a lot of wonderful land out there that's already dedicated to this purpose, and therefore you certainly don't have an NIMBY problem. And you might build out that land with a campus that looks a little bit like a modern high school with a series of satellite units that operated as smaller units. And you might then also imagine leasing some of those to operators whose operations would qualify for Medicaid funding. There are a lot of levels by which this could occur. I use the Portland example simply to say that you don't have to have four layers of razor wire fencing and a great big jail-looking building to have security for mental health patients. There are a variety of ways of delivering that service as well. I wanted to tell you a little anecdote, which I think this is important. I was at a retreat of one of my healthcare clients not long ago when they had a presentation by the president of Virginia Mason Hospital, which is a wonderful hospital in Seattle. But like all hospitals, hospitals are generally inefficient places. You've probably observed that. And as a matter of fact, if you go yourself, you want somebody else to be there because they're sometimes dangerous places. Virginia Mason has enthusiastically adopted Toyota's approach to improving processes. They've sent more than 100 people to Japan. They've built a whole culture of getting frontline people involved in thinking about how we do things differently. And they have many wonderful anecdotal examples from some of their early work with respect to looking at how far we move people around in the hospital, how long we have to wait for lab tests to get back. Why does it take 21 steps to handle a sample in a pathology laboratory? And if you think about much of what we do, including working with people as human beings, it's actually, you can break it down into a series of small steps. And the management challenge for Bob and the superintendent and the governor and everybody else in this system is to take a look at why are we doing things the way we used to do them? Can't we come around and use the same dollars and the same people in different ways that get better outcomes and are actually much more fun and engaging for people to do so that people feel good about coming to work instead of like they're just going through the motions? I think that kind of leadership opportunities are here, but I wouldn't dismiss the fact that the buildings, especially those on the south of Center Street, are beyond hope, and something different should happen architecturally. So that's a much longer answer than you probably expected, but you just gave me two or three softballs there that I wanted to try to take care of. Thank you.
Okay. I think that's what we have. I appreciate your comments very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I've got a few notes that I'd like to pilfer when I write something about this.
I'd be happy to talk to any of you anytime.
I appreciate it very much. We'll now invite Dr. Chandragiri, is that right? Chandragiri forward from Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. He's going to give us a presentation on that facility and their recovery model. We're trying to round up some more members. I'm not sure where the rest of the panel is, but hopefully they're listening on the television. So good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Dalto, and respected members of the committee. I want to thank you all for giving me this opportunity. It was stormy, but I managed to reach Salem, coming from Pendleton, Oregon.
Wow.
I'm a board-certified psychiatrist, and now I work as the chief medical officer in Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. It's a much smaller state hospital. But what I'm going to highlight in today's presentation is about the steps we have undertaken to implement a recovery model of care in Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. There are two sets of handouts. Something's for you to take it and read. But I'm just going to touch upon a few important facts from that. And
before you get started in there, maybe you can give us a perspective of what the different sort of approaches are. This is one approach, the recovery approach. What are the other options? I suppose one is to do nothing and just warehouse people.
Absolutely. That's what we are not going to discuss.
Sure. Okay.
Because one of the things we realized is we can continue business as usual or do something different. And that's what I'm going to present, is how we began to do something different with whatever limited resources we had. We did not have any extra resources. Something to address, talk about organizational cultural change, and how we had to approach in Eastern Oregon. So that's what my presentation would be. And then we found that results are very rewarding, not only for us, but also for those we serve when we start doing business different from as usual. We faced pretty much all the challenges what state hospitals typically face in rural areas, workforce and violence and increased demand, cultural competency, etc. Yet we began to soon see that we are not able to serve the needs of the people who we were supposed to be taking care in our state hospital, and there was a big gap. This kind of and became a, there became a crisis point where we had to close one of the units and move the patients to the two other units, and that gave us an opportunity to see how we can re-engineer our own organization and do business different from what we have been doing. That's where we began to consider the possibility of a recovery model of care. So we started out with a staff retreat. We just decided to get staff from across all levels of organization and said, what can we do differently in order to serve the consumers who have been coming to our care, and how we can embrace recovery model of care in our own hospital within the same old building with the same limited structure without increasing in our staff. So that is the sum of what we did. You know, the topic was interesting. The staff got into it. But then we soon realized that in order to bring about a change, we needed to have four different things. One, we needed to have the necessary skills to adopt what recovery model is all about, what recovery is all about. The second thing, we needed to understand what is our organizational structure. Does that organizational structure itself impede necessary changes, or what kind of changes we need to make? We had to find ways to motivate them within the means that is available to us, and also alleviate any concerns that may come up when we begin to change organizations. So that's the gist of what we did. We had to find a way to train all our staff. We have nearly 115 employees at different levels, and we had to train them what the recovery is, because it's been defined in a variety of ways. So we really agreed upon this definition. A person with mental illness can recover even though the illness is not cured. Recovery is a way of living a satisfying, hopeful, contributing life, even with the limitations caused by the illness. Recovery involves developing a new meaning and purpose in one's life as one grows beyond the effects, catastrophic effect of the mental illness. We talked about what kind of conditions that they need in order to have a different outlook or a different perspective and grow beyond their mental illness. Talked about hope, talked about ways to empower them, how to develop social reconnections, because one of the fallouts of mental illness is they get alienated, how to respect a positive culture of healing, and what kind of recovery-oriented services that we can provide. We had to basically train our staff to explain to them basically how people go through stages of recovery. It doesn't happen all of a sudden, because by the time they reach our hospital, years have gone by and a lot of damage has been done. So we talked about someone who comes in and totally dependent and unaware that they need services, all the way to being interdependent on the system and become aware that at what point of time they need help and what point of time they can be independent and take care of themselves. We used a psychiatric rehabilitation model to teach our staff that they have very complex needs. It's not just taking care of symptoms alone. Things would have been very easy if you had just taken care of symptoms and sent somebody back home. But they also have severe disability. They have difficulty in performing the role function. And they also have severe disadvantage, stigma, poverty, and everything else that goes with mental illness. This is where they begin to appreciate how psychiatric treatment and psychiatric rehabilitation should become a continuum of care, and it should go hand in hand, not just take care of the medications alone and send them home. Because that way you're not preparing them. In that way, they only become more dependent on the system rather than become more independent and functional. We did get some technical assistance. I'm a board member of American Association of Community Psychiatry, so one of the products was recovery-oriented services, and I attend the NASHBED meetings, so we got some technical help from them. We had Dr. Bloom and Dr. Minkoff come and provide us some technical assistance. We visited some best practices in our own state. Then it kind of led us to next level about the organizational structure itself. every organization has its own structure. Sometimes the structure itself can prevent a change in organizational culture. So we needed to kind of identify what we could do to reorganize ourselves in order to bring about the necessary changes or how to support these changes. And whenever organizations change, they go through certain changes, which we call in our addiction literature stages of change, anywhere from pre-contemplation to maintenance change. So we had to support, we had to recognize that different individuals in our own organization are going to go through different stages of change. And whenever there is change, we had to deal with resistance, grief among the employees, and also find ways to keep them motivated, saying, hang in there because these changes are going to be rewarding. So that's where the leadership or the, of the organization comes very useful. If you have a clear vision and support that all along at every level, not only among the staff members, but also the people we are serving, because whenever there is change, there's going to be an outfall on people we are serving. Our experience in the transformation actually is detailed in the handout, so I'm not going to go into all the details, but I'm going to touch upon two important areas which we which helped us quite immensely. One is about the way we went about starting a psychiatric rehabilitation program. When we closed one of our units, that gave me a pool of 18 employees. So I started with that 18 employees and merged a few other departments which were functioning independently and called it a psychiatric rehabilitation program. And that became the core. And then we actually sat with patients in focus groups and said, what kind of activities you find meaningful in your own life? Tell me what goes on in your county, which is helpful in your county. What kind of difficulties you had when you had to access activities outside? So that became a core of, we designed the core program which should go in. Simultaneously, we did some review of literature for evidence-based practices out of UCLA. There are different modules which talks about psychiatric rehabilitation. We actually purchased some of those modules. Altogether, it spent about close to $1,000. That's pretty much. And we trained our staff in order to use those evidence-based practice. We have gone through something like 17 different versions of our treatment activities. We now offer nearly 125 groups and treatment activities each week, 12 hours a day for 5 days a week on weekends. It's a kind of a lighter schedule, but that's a very busy activity which folks find it very useful among the staff members and also those we serve in our program. And one of the things which we focus, in addition to teaching them about these evidence-based practices, is about social skills development, community reentry skills, how to get back and stay successfully in the community. Alcohol and drug, which forms a major part of our relapse and this revolving door, and some kind of pre-vocational and vocational skills which can come handy. We collect all this data in our Excel spreadsheet and use that for our quality improvement and also for some of the information about the treatment planning. Our philosophy is if you build, they will come. It doesn't matter where it is located. It's one of the very busy programs which the data in your handout shows the, in terms of attendance. The second important area we realized was when you design organization, we really have to go from the person we serve, because it's like Toyota industry. I mean, you start a car, you have to find out the height of the car driver. So we said, why not we use the same principle and start from the person we are going to serve and find out what they need and how they can involve in partnership with us. So there are two things which we found very useful. One is the consumer advisory board and the community meeting. This became a major forum in the last 3.5 years for us to design and redesign our own program. This consumer advisory board consists of 8 current patients, staff members from our organization, there's a psychiatrist and a management staff. They actually go and meet in a coffee shop outside for their business meeting. The minutes are kept. Everybody across the organization gets a copy of the minutes. What they essentially do is they critique our own policies and procedures and give us a feedback of how we can reshape our organization. They worked on very important products, and they've given us some very nice suggestions which have been cost effective in terms of implementation. Yet it has supported immensely in their recovery and a feeling of empowerment that they have been involved in redesigning our program. And just to illustrate, among variety of many products, one they asked us, before we used to have 10 minutes weekly phone calls supervised by a staff member, and half the time they won't be able to reach anybody in the family. you know, once a week. So one, they suggested, why don't you have an unlimited phone call? That way, you know, when I did the math, it became very clear. You have a 10-hour staff time engaged in watching somebody make a phone call, and that way you're making them dependent on us. When we decided to have an unlimited call, they started participating in the discharge planning. They started participating, keeping in touch with the family members and keeping in contact with the loved ones. Sometimes they just have no way of reaching out. And yet, it costs far less. I can still use the 10 hours of staff time elsewhere in taking care of other activities. So some of the suggestions have been very useful. And they also participate in a variety of other activities meant to reduce the coercive practices in our state hospital, one being Phoenix Project. The other area which we found very useful to engage folks we serve is the community meeting. As a chief medical officer and my superintendent, we facilitate the meeting. So there is a management staff, there's a psychiatrist, social worker, and a nursing staff. The message we want to send is, we care for your recovery at all levels of our organization. And this is a very well-attended activity, twice a week in each unit. And this is another place where the patients actually give us a feedback of what they think of the program, what they find it useful, what are the difficulties they face both within and outside the hospital. It's been a place where we celebrate graduation of the patient, at the time of discharge we celebrate that and we kind of give them a feedback. It's been another very rewarding place where we reinforce the need for nonviolence and as an important prerequisite for recovery. You know, the other area which we found useful is our patients do face a lot of disadvantage back in the community, and that is because of stigma, poverty, discrimination, everything else that goes. So what we decided to do was we decided to have several things which we found. One, we needed to increase the access to care if folks are in crisis. We didn't want them to get stuck in the criminal justice system or elsewhere. So we decided to change our policy. We said we will admit patients at any time, day or night, voluntarily or involuntarily. And it will be a no wrong door approach. Even if they have a comorbid substance use, we will take care of them. And this allowed us to increase our admissions. Just one of the handouts, our admissions went up from 215 to 293 a year without any change, just by changing our way of approaching. We use the term no wrong door approach. So they will come. And we kind of have a very welcoming attitude. We just actually go and receive, our staff actually go and receive them before they actually come into the hospital and the police bring them. The other thing what we started using is Umatilla County Crisis Coordinating Council. Umatilla County is our greatest source of admission. Most of our admissions come from that county. So we started a meeting once a month with the local sheriff, local ER, law enforcement, NAMI, consumer advocates, and several other agencies, mainly to see how we can use different agencies in a way that does not cause undue burden on any of them, yet facilitate access to care in a timely manner. This has been a very rewarding experience for all of us in terms of networking and cross-training each other, and patients, if they get stuck in any of these different agencies, they get the right help at the right time. We also go over all the crisis log on a monthly basis from that county. We actually go and ask ourselves questions. Why this person didn't come to our hospital? Why this person ended up in a county jail instead of coming to our hospital? So it kind of gives us a forum to cross-train and ask this kind of questions, which is almost like doing a critical incident meeting at monthly basis. We also started what's called a Point of Hope and the Pendleton NAMI. Actually, we started in our program and then we supported that program along with local consumers, families, etc. It's a consumer drop-in center. This also becomes a very nice training ground for our patients when they are admitted. We actually take them on a field trip to these places so that they get an experience of what they can do when they go back to their own counties in terms of using these resources in order to support their own recovery. So this has become a very positive experience. And one of our former patients, we actually ended up hiring as a staff member. So he has been very instrumental in forming this bridge for us. our efforts have been very rewarding. Our staff members appreciate it. Those we serve appreciate it. We get lots of letters. But we also have received a lot of national recognition. In the handout, I have a news clip from Psychiatric News, which is the newsletter of American Psychiatric Association, which essentially describes what we have done, Oregon DHS newsletter. And we have also presented our implementation of a recovery model in 3 national conferences in Hawaii, Washington, D.C., and most recently in Oregon Psychiatric Association Waterman Lunch presentation. You know, measuring recovery can be challenging because it's such an individual journey. But from an administrative point of view, I need to have some sense what facets of recovery I can measure. So in your handout, it's a challenging area. It's a kind of a new area, and we have lots of data to support that it is a rewarding experience. In your handout, you'll see data to support why those we serve value this program. After we started all this, prior to this, we used to have something like 1,000 monthly patient contacts in any treatment activity. Now, for the last 3 years, there has been over 4,000 patient contacts on a monthly basis. Some months, we have even touched 5,000 patient contacts, the same 60 patients attending an activity. This has also helped those folks who have stayed very long periods of time in our hospital. From anywhere from 40 contacts each month in treatment activity, they've gone up to 100 or over 100 in some cases. Some of them have been discharged for years. For the last 2 to 3 years, they stayed in the community. By changing the way we welcome those in need, we have increased our admissions. Our hospital has the highest rate of admissions and discharges among all the state-run psychiatric hospitals in the state of Oregon. We've seen a marked decrease in coercive practices in terms of restraint use has practically disappeared. Our staff injury claims have decreased over time. We also wanted to study both from the staff point of view what they think in terms of recovery-oriented services and also our patients. So we used two other instruments. One is American Association of Community Psychiatrists Recovery-Oriented Services Evaluation and MISHEP. Those two data is also included. But we do recognize that we have long ways to go. We are not there yet. And we are in the stage of making a paradigm shift. It's just like, so, and there are a lot of people who have really worked hard in our hospital, and folks in the community have supported us through, and this is where we are. We have a small write-up, which I've included about our Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. It talks about mission and who we serve, etc. This is something I thought I'll share, and thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Well, I have a couple of questions, I suppose. You made a comment about the advances you're making in collecting data on treatment planning. I'm wondering if you're able to share that information beyond your facility, but to other facilities around the state, other state facilities.
We do that. Some of the data we do share. NASHPID is National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. They have all the state hospitals together send 16 benchmark data. We have participated in a few of them. So they give us, basically adjusted data according to our facility size with respect to national levels and how we fare across in different places. So we do have one means of that. But we do not share among all the other psychiatric hospitals in Oregon.
Well, why wouldn't you share that?
Because there are private psychiatric hospitals and other state hospitals. We do share in our weekly meeting in among the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, between the two state hospitals, we do share the data. But I don't know of any forum where we share our data with the private psychiatric hospitals in Oregon.
Okay, well, do you think that it might be appropriate, given the advances that you've made with involving patients in their own recovery?
The only place I got an opportunity to share with 60 psychiatrists was in Waterman Lunch presentation in Oregon Psychiatric Association winter meeting, which was held last month in Oregon. So that was the place that I had a forum where I could share this data. Maybe at some point of time we can think in terms of at least having some aggregate data posted in such a way that it will give more people choices to make which hospital to choose or what kind of services are available. We are in a point where we have enough data to provide some kind of technical consultation to different places.
Okay. Then I had another question about your slides on access to care and the no wrong door approach. I guess I wanted to get some clarification about the successes that you're showing about increasing the rate of admissions and discharges. It seems to me like in these two pieces of data you have, your numbers are going up, but you're pointing to that as a success. I would think to me that the numbers of people that are being treated and maybe not coming back or not being treated in the first place would be more successful to catch folks before they hit a point where they need to be treated.
I agree with you. We have to talk in terms of case identification, the new patients. We also have to talk in terms of readmission rate, because that gives us a good sense of what the whole system is all about, not only the hospital system, but the community mental health system and how they can support it. So I agree with you. We need to kind of find a way to divide the data in terms of new cases that have ended up in hospital. To me, if anybody ends up in a hospital, means they have reached the safety net rather than being picked up in the community and treated in an earlier stage.
The conversations that you're having with the Umatilla County folks, are you talking about strategies, are you sharing strategies with them to help prevent folks from reaching that level of the hospital in the first place?
Yes. We have provided several training programs for their crisis team and the entire team in terms of psychiatric emergencies and how to identify patients when they are in the stage of urgency before it becomes an emergent problem and how to troubleshoot that. So, and we have opened up all our training programs, staff training program, to staff members of Umatilla County and all the others who are in our coordinating council network.
Mr. Nichol, do you have some perspective?
For the record, my name is Bob Nichol. I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Just a perspective. Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center is a unique hospital in this state in that it does both long-term care, which state hospitals do, but it's also the acute care resource for most of Eastern Oregon. So it's a little hard, frankly, to do cross comparisons on admissions because there is no other hospital quite like this in the state. So we do comparisons for the acute care portion of what Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center does with other acute care hospital, which are general units in general or psychiatric units in general hospitals. And I just also comment that, as you may have read in the paper, there are major changes going on at Umatilla County, and there will be a new program taking over the services there. The Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center worked very, very closely with Umatilla County Mental Health when they were operating the program, but we found it necessary for the first time to make a change because we felt that the county simply was not able to provide the standard of care that needed to be dealt with. So on April 1st, a new program is coming in, and Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center is already talking with them and working on the coordination issues.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late and missing your early part of your testimony. Maybe you've already discussed this, but I'm wondering what your readmission rate is. Do you have those figures?
Chairman Dalto and Vice Chair Tomei, I don't have the numbers with me offhand, but I'll be happy to share that with you, or I can send it to you.
Okay, and follow-up. Thank you. Are most of your patients from Eastern Oregon, and so what proportion would be from Eastern Oregon?
Most of our acute admissions are from Eastern Oregon. But we do get patients for extended care from the valley as well. About roughly 65% of our admissions are acute admissions each year, each month.
So how long would they stay for acute care?
Acute care, they can stay anywhere around a month to 40, 50 days sometimes.
And if it's long-term, then how long might they stay?
We have a bimodal number. There are about 11 patients who stayed for more than a year, and the rest are around less than that, between 6 months to a year sometimes.
Yeah. So, Bob, if I could ask you to follow up on that, because I'm assuming that patients that are going to be more long-term, they would probably go to their state hospital here in Salem, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, it really depends on which of the civil commitment units has a bed available. When someone is determined to be ready for extended care, they're still in an acute care hospital on this side of the mountains, then it depends on whether Dr. Chandra Gary has a bed available or there's a bed available at the Portland campus or sometimes at the Salem campus. So this is a triage situation usually where we're trying to make the best fit as quickly as we can for patients coming from this side of the mountains to the other units.
So I'm still not clear. So Bob, if somebody in Eastern Oregon had to be in longer term than a year, then they would be brought to the state hospital here in Salem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, generally if it's an Eastern Oregon admission for acute care, we try to leave them at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, even if it's going to be an extended care.
I see.
On occasion, for example, if a person really needs specialized geropsychiatric treatment, we would consider a transfer to the geropsychiatric program here in Salem, but that doesn't happen all that often.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure, thank you. Representative Cameron.
Dr. Sean McGarry, thank you for your testimony. It was great. You mentioned that you changed the way you welcome people. Yeah. Can you describe for us what it used to be and what it looks like now?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, before we had our own admission policies, which were very restrictive. For instance, we would have policy which says somebody cannot be admitted on a voluntary basis in the evening or weekends. So we removed that and we said at any point of time they can come in. The practice was patients would be brought in by the sheriff's department in chains, handcuffed and brought into the hospital, sometimes in the sight of other patients. So we decided to remove that, and we would have a staff member actually meet them outside the hospital, and if it is safe enough, get them to remove the handcuff and then bring them into the hospital. And when patients would come in, they would have to participate in an orientation group. Half the time they are in crisis, it was hard for them to recognize what is going on in the hospital. So with the advice from our consumer advisory board, we developed a welcome packet which is given to them, which has very minimum information but enough to start with. And then we have a group where one of the management staff and also the consumer advocate, who is a former consumer, now a staff member, sit and kind of go over the orientation. Before, we would have a rather restrictive approach if somebody had a co-occurring substance use. Now we removed that and said, you know, even if they have a co-occurring substance use, unless they are medically endangered, we would still admit them into our hospital. We developed a paper for Umatilla County saying how they would come in order to ensure that they don't get unnecessarily stuck with the sheriff's department or in the local emergency room, and they come to us if they have a psychiatric need as quickly as possible from the time. We developed a screening sheet which facilitates admission in a rapid manner, and we keep data of those who sought help yet we could not help them because of the shortage of bed. And we keep in touch with the county and support them while they are waiting to come in. So we just tell them that, okay, these are the things. Sometimes we have gone to the extent of calling the local medical doctor to see how they can support the person in crisis while the person is waiting for a bed available. So these some approaches have come very handy in helping us welcome them.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Cameron. Representative Boone.
Just to follow up on that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chair Dalto, maybe that's the kind of issues that you can share with other hospitals, is some of the procedures that you're doing to make things a lot smoother for their entry into the hospital. Is that possible then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, yes, it is possible. There are some educational format we can share, or if that is what you meant, or can also share some of our experience of what helped us re-engineer our own organization and see if that could come handy.
Thank you.
If I might add, Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, we have an every other week meeting in which we talk about these very kinds of ideas with all of the key executive staff of the state hospitals. So some of this is already beginning to happen, and I think we've adapted various parts of this. Each population, as Mr. Ader mentioned, has some differences. So everything that works at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center might not be directly applicable to the maximum security unit, say, at Oregon State Hospital, but the kind of thinking that we're doing is something that we are sharing among ourselves a lot these days.
Okay. Well, I thank you both very much, Dr. Chandragiri, for braving the elements to make it all this way. We appreciate your comments, and that's really a very innovative thing you're doing there. So I hope we can continue the discussion. We'll move next to Maynard Hammer, who is the Deputy Superintendent at the Oregon State Hospital, who will give us an update on the master plan and their physical plan situation. Good afternoon. Welcome. And then after that, we'll have a panel with the Service Employees International Union and the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, a panel of four folks who will sort of present some perspectives, and then we'll have members of the public are able to testify after that. If you haven't had an opportunity to sign up to testify, make sure your name's on the sign-up sheet so we can get to everybody and plan our time accordingly. Dr. Hammer. Who's a doctor? Mr. Hammer.
Maynard Hammer.
Right.
Not clinical. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Maynard Hammer, Deputy Superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. I'm happy to be here today. My presentation is really more oriented toward facts and figures. However, I think the direct connections are pretty apparent. Mr. Ader set a very good context for master planning and the types of programs we heard from Dr. Chandragiri. One wants to have appropriate treatment spaces to provide those kinds of programs. So I would like to start with a brief description of kind of what the hospital looks like, and I think the handouts you have, I provided a campus map, and then we'll talk a bit about master planning and the public process involved there, and I've included our, as the last handout, a synopsis of our attempt to move our technology a little closer to the 21st century. The physical plant at Oregon State Hospital is takes some reckoning. Really, we're on 144 acres within the Salem city limits. We've got about 75 buildings. The hospital was founded. The first building was actually opened in 1883 in our famous J complex, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Of our square footage building space, we've got about 1.2 million square feet of space. Of that, about 970,000 feet can we actually occupy, and we are using all of that. That's 80% of the usable space on the campus where we can put patients, ancillary services, for example, food service, physical plant, those kinds of services. The rest of the square footage, which is about 20%, is basically so deteriorated that it's unoccupiable and unusable. So from a practical standpoint, we are at a point of departure where we really don't have any space to add additional treatment units, even if that were the way the state wanted to go. We also lease a facility in Portland. It's a 61,000-foot facility we lease from Legacy. The lease ends March 31 of this year, but the Department of Administrative Services is actively working to extend that lease under an option included in the original lease. It's our best treatment space. It's our most modern treatment space. The lease cost is actually very good. Even with the new lease rate for the first 3 years, we're still only about $1.50 a square foot, which Portland hospitals face. That's pretty good space. The hospital campus, including Portland and Salem both, we have two licenses basically. One's a hospital license, and that is a bed capacity of 672 hospital beds. Now the licenses are actually in two different sites, but I'm just speaking total hospital. We have a licensed capacity of 104 beds for residential capacity. That 104 presently is all in forensics and all on the Salem campus. The Portland facility has 68 beds, and those are all adult treatment services, primarily civil commitments. Our budgeted capacity is 704 patients. Today our population was 737. That's not correct. It's higher than that. We were 55 over our budgeted capacity in our forensic area. Our major capital project that we're involved in right now is trying to expand our local area network and actually get PCs out to our users who can use those. We've had for a lot of years, and still are, because we haven't cut over completely. We have two email systems. One is an antiquated AS400 system. It's a powerful mini computer, but it's not very good for modern communication, and it doesn't communicate with the outside world. So about 200 of us have had actual PCs that can communicate with the outside world. So anything that came in that had to be disseminated around the campus had to be distributed hard copy or rekeyed. I actually created an estimate to answer Representative Greenlit's question on Monday about what it would take to demolish the J building. What we did, because we couldn't find any of those old studies, we went to an up-to-date means manual for hospital space. A means manual is a manual of construction costs, and estimators use that. And what we came out with, and why this will indicate one reason why people haven't been too quick to demolish the building, is roughly $4.8 million. And the reason it's so expensive is it's a very large building. It's 284,000 square feet, and it costs about 27 cents to demolish it. But then there are add-ons for asbestos, flooring, roofing, lead-based paint, thermal insulation. It's encapsulated asbestos-containing material in the tunnels. All that's an add-on, so it's a difficult building to demolish. That really would equate, I boil that down to 52,000 dump truck loads of material if we were to demolish that. That's what it would take to move the material off the campus. 50% of that building is unoccupiable and basically unusable except for recycling furniture. So that's a good piece of the amount of space that we have that we can't use. Large parts of it are very deteriorated, very dilapidated, with water coming in from the roof and penetrating all the way to the first floor. So there's a lot of deterioration there. And if you would look at your map, the J building is the large building right in the middle, and it's called a J because from the top, if you look at it from the air, look at the footprint, it is actually a J, with the shank of the J running east and west along Center Street there. And that building, again, was open. The first part of it was open in 1883, and I can't find really reliable dates as to construction periods, but the construction types are slightly different, although connected, but they look to me to be all having been built within, say, a 25, 30-year period. So they're all very old. Now, with that kind of a context, if you will, let me move into the master planning some. Let me talk about the master plan. This master planning process, we're hoping to have a little different outcome than the classic master plan. There are usually several different kinds of facilities plans, ranging from engineering condition assessments through to campus master plans, where architectural firms are invited in to figure out how you could better use your land and where you want your building to start designing things. We decided early on that what we really need was exactly what Mr. Ader said. Systems planning and facilities planning are very similar in that you really want to know where you want to go before you start doing something. Architects call it programming, and in facilities planning, it's called the program drives the facility. You have to know what you want to do, what treatments you want to do, how many steps do you want to take to retrieve your pharmacy, as Dr. Chandragiri was talking about the efficiencies in hospital design. You have to kind of know what you want to do before you can start worrying about what kind of facilities you want. But the second thing we need to know, and it relates directly to what you heard earlier, is the role we've charged the master planners with is help us provide a picture of what the role of the state hospital should be in the mental health system. How should we relate to it? What services should we provide that cannot be provided in the community, if any? There's no preordained conclusion here. And once we have that, then look at a number of different elements, including should there be a separate forensic hospital? Should there be a different hospital? Should there be regional facilities and those types of things? And if you look at your handout, the Exhibit A statement of work, this actually is from the contract for the architectural firm. We went through a formal selection process. We met Bob Nickel, Barry Cass, the director's office was involved, the governor's office was involved. We also involved the Department of Administrative Services. They do a lot of master plans, although they don't do them in a healthcare setting. And we tried to figure out how to do this. In reality, a master planning process is usually a year long, if not longer. So what we were responding to was a Senate president's request to try to provide something that would guide this legislative session so that the legislative assembly could understand kind of what the issues were and maybe get some guidance on what direction to proceed. That's a very short planning process. So we did a formal procurement. We actually had two responses and selected KMD, Kaplan McLaughlin Diaz, who has a lot. They have a lot of experience in master planning and planning healthcare kinds of uses. Our procurement requested and they provided experts in mental health planning. So we have, with the team of KMD, the New Heights Group out of New Mexico, and they are professional mental health system planners, and they are starting to work through the planning piece of it. So we are really hoping that we can provide the Legislative Assembly and the Governor a picture of what the role of the hospital should be, and given that role, and given the types of services that should be provided, what should the hospital look like, if anything, and where should it actually be? Or should it be in several different places? Now, the master planning process is in two phases. The first phase is a very short period of time, 60 days. So that's titled a framework plan, and what that means in planning parlance is you're not going to have time to really get in and develop all these issues. So they're going to have to identify the major issues and provide enough summary treatment of those so there's enough substance in the report to provide guidance. But underlying all of this was the need to have a public process and the need to have our stakeholders involved. And in fact, in a master planning process, the process is nearly as important as the product. So you will see attendant as another handout here. There is a steering committee which is set up to guide the master planning process. It's called the OSH Master Plan Steering Committee. That has already met in an engagement meeting, informational meeting with the consultants. The purpose of the steering committee, although everyone on that committee is a stakeholder, the purpose of the steering committee is to really manage the process and try to ensure that the architectural firm, the consultants, produce the scope of work and the product that that we believe the Legislative Assembly and the Governor needs for guidance. In addition to the steering committee, you will also see there a stakeholders contact list, and that represents a list of key stakeholders that, even though this is a very short planning process, really need to be involved. And right now there are two activities being undertaken by the consultants. The New Heights consultant, which is a mental health system planner, is setting up hour-long phone conversations with every member of the steering committee, and they're out of New Mexico. They'll be doing it by phone and making periodic visits to Oregon. And the KMD, the consultants that are local, are setting up very specific meeting schedules and times and interviews to try to provide a lot of information, input for the key stakeholders. So those will both be going on, and I'd hope to have a hard copy of the actual meeting schedule today, but it's just now being developed. The other thing that's going on is an architect and a structural engineer are touring the campus and doing what one would call a condition assessment. They're actually rating the buildings. They're looking at them in terms of, can they be reused? Are they structurally so deteriorated that there is no reuse? Some of that is required in any kind of a planning or design activity, because if legislative assembly and the governor would ever want to fund something, you're going to want to know, what is it we have on that campus that can be used for something else, or should everything be torn down, or what is it that happens to what's there, because there's a lot of material there. And some of the buildings are not dilapidated or deteriorated. They're actually not in bad shape, but they are not good modern treatment space. So they lack simple amenities like air conditioning, for example. We have geropsychiatric wards that get to 90 degrees in the summer because we can't air condition the building. The building itself is not in bad shape, but it was not constructed with the right kind of amenities to operate a treatment facility. So those things are going on in the master plan process. Let me stop a moment, see if there are any questions on that.
Okay. I guess I do have a question. I was going to wait till the end of your presentation, but should I'm not sure what the outcome is going to be with this master plan, but should some kind of plan come out of that process to do some kind of replacement for the future? Are we talking 10 years? Are we talking 5 years? What's the timeline for something like that?
For development and replacement of a major facility like that would probably be, if we started today, would probably take 8 years. Give or take, that would be pretty good. If we actually started, there are a lot of issues involved in siting, including the use of present state-owned space, the present site, for example, which the city of Salem likes to look at periodically. It's in the city limit, and it's a fairly nice setting, even though there are some land uses adjacent, like the Oregon State Penitentiary, that are not necessarily compatible with some other uses. But it's an occupied facility. So even if you use the same site, there has to be some transition planned and carried out to care for the patients that we have there now. It's among the more difficult kinds of projects to replace or expand an existing facility that's a secure facility like a psychiatric hospital or a prison on the site where it's already occupied. So that and the process of figuring out what the alternatives would be, how they might be designed, and the funding and design and the approval process and the public process involved in working through it would take a considerable amount of time.
What is the significance of the shaded areas on the hospital grounds map?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I think I saw that once years ago, and I think at some point it was meant to denote the areas of the J building that really weren't available for use, but some parts of that have been remodeled to make use for treatment spaces. And the 50 building, of course, is that's our newest building. It's a 1955 building. It's one of our more dysfunctional buildings architecturally in terms of how it works in ventilation and those kinds of things, but it's occupied. It's got about 330 or 40 patients in there, so I'm not sure what the shading is.
Okay, all right, thanks.
the last thing I'll touch on here, and it's just a matter of it's as much a sign of the state of the campus as anything, is the connectivity project. This would be probably minor news in many other agencies for the state hospital. We've been with technology that was not compatible with any other state government technology for so long. The opportunity to actually provide a local area network around the campus presented itself. We've had tremendous support from the other offices in the Department of Human Services, including helping us buy PCs and putting us, taking over our assets and actually providing replacement PCs. So you'll see at the bottom there that don't be, the 40% expended out of the budget is kind of misleading. We didn't know how much it would take to do that project because it's an old facility and we always run into problems. In actuality, we allocated $600,000. We've had a lot of breaks go our way. We were able to use the Department of Administrative Services telecommunications contract with Verizon, so we didn't have to go do a separate procurement. A lot of the buildings had wire. They weren't connected to the outside, but they had up to standard wiring in them, so we didn't have to do as much of that. And so right now we're on a schedule to have the campus connected by probably the last part of April, early May. We'll have the local area network fiber in. We'll have the buildings cabled and the PC deployment, where we're actually moving PCs out to the workstation. Lags behind that a little bit, but that's coming along also. The one major piece that we don't have, and we're trying to work through that now, is we'll have the connectivity, but our hospital management systems that help us comply with all the modern requirements of the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Facilities, licensing requirements, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Management, they're all on the old mainframe system accessed through the AS400 on campus. We're trying very hard to find ways to purchase a new hospital management system so we can manage the patient census and do things like have online ordering and inventorying for our pharmacy company. It turns out, why this is so important, it turns out to be very inefficient and expensive. We did a major procurement for a reference laboratory, which backstops the laboratory we have on campus. We've had Quest for quite a while. It was a formal procurement through Department of Administrative Services. The problem is that with the AS400 programming, if we had gotten another reference lab and they had different kinds of formats to send their information in, the AS400 has to be programmed manually for every change. There is a major team computer experts at Department of Human Services that works on that continually, because every medication, when a reference number changes for a blood level for that medication, it has to be hand programmed. You can't just go on a keyboard and change it. So being networked and having a proper management system will get rid of all that and actually make it so we can communicate as we want to with other hospitals, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Many of us can do that now. But you were raising the question earlier about communicating with other hospitals. The system I'm talking about is called OPRCS, Oregon Patient and Resident Care System. A lot of hospitals use that, not just us, because it's tracking patient census. It's coupled with a system in another mainframe system, which tracks eligibility and place in the mental health system. So it's a very widely used kind of a system, and it's very outdated. So that's my presentation, Mr. Chair.
It's a comment. Maybe some of the 12-year-old kids that work upstairs here can help you out. They're very innovative. I'm being facetious. They're all over it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, thank you for that.
I'm sure it's like a manpower issue, person power. Okay, well, I appreciate your presentation very much, Mr. Hammer, and we will move on now to the the public employee panels. So why don't we invite AFSCME and FCIU forward to do their presentation. Mary's going to come first. Okay. All right. We're going to start off with Mary Botkin, Joe Thurman, and is that Lauren Worthington?
Lauren
Worthington.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I want to first thank you, Mr. Chair, for accommodating my double booking myself this evening. Actually, not double booking, but I just have a meeting in Portland I also have to be to, and so I appreciate you letting me come up here, and I apologize to the committee in advance that I do have to leave right away. Let me sort of set the stage, step away, and then let the employees talk, because I think the employees can tell you sort of what it's like on a daily basis better than I can, and you need to hear from them, not me. I live with you every day, so we can talk all the time, and we'll let them take it from there. Let me just say a couple of things. We think, as a union, we have a position that OSH is a critical part of the mental health system. Not necessarily the buildings as they stand, but the concept that we need some sort of centralized treatment facility that serves everybody at every level as a last resort, that nobody has to wander the streets for a lack of care because there is no facility available. And so whatever the configuration of OSH and the Oregon State Hospital is, once we're finished with the long-term plan, I think we need to see that as a long-term resource for the mentally ill and for the communities that have mentally ill and need to have some sort of stable, well-funded system of care in place. It always disturbs me when anybody talks about saving money by changing the system. You know, we did that in the 70s. And the way we saved money was to shut down damage, shut down other beds, and put people in the streets. Not immediately. They kind of stopped at a group home on the way. But now they wander the streets, and it's very distressing to all of us. And so what we should be looking for is a long-term solution where the streets aren't part of our system of care, but rather that we have a system of care that provides for the needs of this community at every level. One of the things that AFSCME is very interested in is some sort of facility that breaks down what we consider to be artificial barriers. We think there are artificial barriers between the criminal population that is mentally ill and the mentally ill population that is criminal. And what we need to do is to establish a system that allows us to place people where they belong and not house them based on whether they had a good lawyer or a bad lawyer, whether they made good decisions or bad decisions, but rather, if they're a criminal with mental illness, we need to treat them for their mental illness and then return them to the prison environment. Instead, what we're doing is we're putting them in the prison environment, and we have corrections officers who aren't trained to handle the mental illness, that are trying to deal with the mentally ill in an environment where it's not set up and to house them. And we have folks in that our members will tell you about that are so violent they really are criminal, and they need help in being trained on how to handle those individuals, as do, I'm sure, SEIU's members feel the same way, but I'll let them speak for themselves. We need to find stable, long-term financing for both the folks who are in custody as well as those who are not in custody. We need a system that provides for caseworking services, for those who have been discharged so that they stay on their medication, they stay in their in housing, and they're taking, I mean, they have the needs that they are unable to provide for themselves taken care of, and they have somebody sort of watching to make sure that they stay properly medicated and that they don't fall into the trap of self-medication through illicit drugs and alcohol. Then I think the other thing we need to do is we need to figure out for once and for all, what do we want and what's it going to cost? If we want a system that is going to adequately treat this population, then we need a number. K through 12 says their number is 4.9, 5.3. Pick a number, that's the number. We don't have a number. It's hard to ask anybody for anything if you don't know how much it is. And so we need to, at some level, while we're doing the long-range planning, also come up with the optimum budget. I want a system that says, I don't care where you live or what your diagnosis is, we will have a service for you. That's my dream. And we're not going to put you in prison just because you're mentally ill and because it's the only bed we have available. That's not okay either. And so I think that, you know, we have a lot of work to do. I want you to know that as a union, we're making a long-term commitment to work with you to solve these problems. You know, we're not going to agree every day, all day. But if we can keep our goals in mind, which is to adequately serve this population, then I think we get there if we do it together and if we work hard at it and our members are willing to roll up their sleeves and do whatever we can do to help. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. All right. Appreciate it.
My name is Joe Thurman. I'm a registered nurse at Oregon State Hospital in the forensics unit, and I believe I've been in front of this committee before. I've been there since 1998, and I work in the. Before that, I worked in the private sector providing mental health services for clients with chronic mental illness. I think that we can all agree that the Oregon mental health system is broke, and we need to fix it from the county level throughout the whole system, not just at the state hospital, but at the. And some serious problems. The problems start at the county level and run throughout. A good example of this is how a patient who was convicted of 5 DUIs and the judge, DA, and defense attorney got together and made a deal for diminished capacity. We now have them at the state hospital. Instead of an outpatient A&D program that person could be placed in, they were sent to the state hospital, which at this time now they have approximately 5 years to do. Now that person could have been better served in the community at an A&D program instead of sent. But we have given the court systems and the judges in particular the powers to make some of those decisions, and I think it's time that we have the professionals make those decisions for them. I think that the people in the counties need to be able to send their people to the state hospital in every county and not have the judges make those decisions, to have them professionally evaluated by someone who's competent in psychiatry in order to make those determinations. Once they're in the system, they're ours. We have no mechanisms in place to move them out of the system into corrections if that's where they need to be, or into an A&D outpatient treatment facility if that's what they need. People with drug and alcohol problems and sexual predators should not be placed in a hospital designed to help the chronically mentally ill. I mean, they end up victimizing not only the other patients, but also the patients, also the staff. They're the ones that the majority of the assaults happen against. I mean, are caused by. We are finding it harder and harder to attract qualified mental health professionals that want to do therapy into an environment that is both grossly underpaid and may be assaulted at any time. It also makes it hard to place chronically mentally ill patients back in the community when you're putting them in there with sexual predators, because the community sees the sexual offenders and they relate them to the chronically mentally ill. And so whenever they get out in the community, they put the two and two together. They must all be sex offenders. And so it makes it more difficult to get placement for them in the community. Many people have asked, do we need a state hospital? To that I have to answer yes. I think the state needs and owes the chronically mentally ill a place where they can go for safe, effective treatment. And the state hospital is that. If you privatize state hospital, you run into situations where they are paid by the bed, and the incentive to get people out into the community is lost. That's how I feel about it. What we do need, I have been working along with ASME members from corrections, and we both agree that those patients with mental illness should be cared for in a hospital setting, not a correctional setting. What we need is an integrated system to be able to move people with chronic mental illness to OSH for treatment, at the same time move people to the Department of Corrections who do not have a major mental illness. What we're seeing more and more of at the state hospital is people that are meth-induced psychosis. And after several months of being in the hospital, they clear. They no longer have a psychosis, but now they have a diagnosis. And so they're stuck in the mental health system, and there's no mechanism to move them on into corrections where they should be. They're on no medications. I have patients that take a vitamin in the morning, and that's it. So why are we using our resources for the truly ill to take care of people that have no mental illness? I mean, that's a waste of our resources. And at the same time, corrections has people in there that are mentally ill that should be in the state hospital and getting treatment. Is the state hospital in desperate need of changes? I think so. They need to be more supportive of staff, which are assaulted on almost a daily basis. I mean, I gave you figures up there of the assault rate from last year, but even in January, and I forgot to bring that with me, the assault rate from January of last year to January of this year went up 105% in 1 month. I mean, that's ludicrous, and we have no protections. Where is the security, you might ask? To that I answer, what security? Security at the state hospital is a joke. We don't have security. Security doesn't help us when we have to go in there and do an intervention. Very rarely do they even show up on the unit. They have one person that wands people in the forensics. I'm talking about in the forensics program. Wands people as they come into the visitor center on the weekends. One person. The staff said, well, while they're out wanding people, there's nobody inside watching the visitors. Stuff gets routinely passed back and forth. And what we're asking for is a real security team to help with violent behaviors, but also to help keep contraband, such as meth, from getting to our patients. That is where corrections could help. But we want to stay focused. We want to be a hospital, not a prison. But we could use the help of the correction security piece that they use in screening people and making sure that the contraband doesn't get in, to making sure that people are protected, that if somebody's acting up, that there is a mechanism to help support the staff. But I don't ever want to kid myself. I don't want to become a corrections institution. I want the treatment model in place. Our people in the state of Oregon deserve that. Nothing less than that. I mean, we closed damage and made promises to the people when we closed damage that there would be services in the community, and there weren't any. Because of Measure 5 or whatever reasons, there's a lot of people that are left without services. My wife works for a private nonprofit organization dealing with the chronically mentally ill. And I hear about it all the time, about people that are falling through the cracks out into the system because there's no resources out there, because they're truly ill at the time, and there's no safety net for them. We need more crisis beds, and we need more community intervention in order to make this workable in the state of Oregon. Now, I have to give some kudos to the new administration. At least Dr. Fickell is trying hard to make the changes at OSH, and so is DHS, and be more supportive of staff. He even works weekends on call and sees firsthand what we are dealing with. The old administration never would have done that. I mean, the staff at the hospital were basically a cog in a machine with the old administration. At least they're starting to see us as human beings and people that care. We also feel that better oversight of community mental health programs needs to be done by the state of Oregon to ensure what we're seeing is we're seeing people placed into the community, and then the services that they need to be successful, such as social services, drug and alcohol treatment placements and stuff like that, are not available to them. So they're falling back through the crack, they're decomp, and they're coming back to the hospital. That shouldn't happen. We should have we need a short-term facility somewhere that they could do 30, 90 days, whatever it is, to get them stabilized back on their meds and back out. that is would be the ideal thing. Instead of the long term, which now when they go back underneath the PSRB, it's a long term thing. I mean, I had a patient the other day that was revoked for a dirty UA that turns out that it was a false positive. Well, he's been there for over a month. I mean, that shouldn't happen. Do you know what I mean? False positive for alcohol. That shouldn't happen. He should have been treated in an outpatient drug and alcohol program instead of having to come all the way back into the state hospital. That's where the system
is. Is that a PSRB issue?
That was a PSRB issue. He got revoked down at the county level, actually. I think the case manager made the decision to revoke him. But that kind of thing we see on a regular basis. Another patient that I have is a similar case. He tested positive for alcohol. So they revoked him back into the hospital. Well, he's been stable in his meds for years and years and years. He drank some beer, and he admitted to it, and he tested positive for him. They revoked him. We took him back in front of the PSRB, tried to get him back out because there's no reason for him to be there. The longer he's there, he loses his bed, and he loses his spot in the community. PSRB told us no. He had to stay there at least 6 months. And that's fact, because I read it. That's ridiculous. That person could have been treated in an outpatient or an inpatient drug and alcohol facility and never needed to come back into the state system. That's where our community mental health is breaking down. And in order for the mental health system to work throughout the state of Oregon, it needs to be from top to bottom redone. We cannot have a great hospital if we don't have the community resources to support it. We have to have both. We have to have the mechanisms in place to keep people out there and to catch people and help them walk through the system. Because it's a very complicated system that the mentally ill have to jump through a lot of hoops in order to get services out in the community. And some of them are incapable of doing that. And we need to be able to provide that for them.
Joe, we probably need to wrap up so I can get to everybody.
I know, I'm trying, trying to hurry. We would like to see the laws changed to make it a safer and better place for the mentally ill to live. I guess the bottom line is Oregonians need to step up to the plate, fund the changes that need to happen, and you as lawmakers need to change the law so that DOC and OSH can work together to treat our population in the most humane way possible. That's all I got.
Thanks very much. And then Lauren.
Mr. Chairperson and the members of the panel, my name is Lori Worthington. I'm a registered nurse currently working recovery services on Portland campus on Ward 1A. I have worked for the state of Oregon for 18 and a half years. I worked at Damaged until the mandate of its closure in 1994. I transferred to the Oregon State Hospital with what was slated to be the only adult treatment clients. After the actual closure of Damish, the Portland campus had to be established to accommodate those patients who could not be placed in the community. That need continues today. As demonstrated by the growing waiting list to transfer patients from secure placements, community programs, jails or prisons, the emergency rooms, and forensic programs. Unfortunately, several community resources are no longer available to our mentally ill clients, such as the Ryle Center, the Woodland Park Hospital, Pacific Gateway, and Providence Access Triage. The clients we serve are the most severely chronic and acutely mentally ill population. In some cases, aggressive and or assaultive, or so fragile they can't even care for their basic needs or safety. The hospital has been a safety net for this population by providing a structured and secure environment. Our clients are repeatedly readmitted as often as 3 or 4 months after just being discharged. And they're just reestablished on their medication and discharged, only to find that they are readmitted to an emergency room or in jail or prison, wandering the streets or dead. Historically, these clients have had minimal therapy, life skill training, or transitional reintegration. This lack of intense therapy and training continues to be a barrier to changing this pattern of unsuccessful placements. The hospital can provide the venue to support and evaluate this process. Currently, most placements are based on community willingness and not necessarily client readiness. If we continue to send our clients into the community unprepared, we can only expect to perpetuate this cycle. Unfortunately, this reflects only the perception that the client is unsuccessful with placement. Therefore, another resource is potentially lost for that client. With the minimal resources available to our mentally ill population, we cannot afford to lose any more resources. Thank you.
Thanks very much. That revolving door, Lori, that you're talking about with some of the hospital patients, is that up in at the Portland facility?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make that clear. All right. Thank you very much. And then I'm not sure who our next guest is, but I think you'll let us know.
Mr. Chairperson and members of the committee, my name is Jean Dalton. I am a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, and I work in the Darrow Psychiatric Program at Oregon State Hospital. I'm here today to really tell you about a program that has not been publicized in Oregonian. All of the publicity that's gone on has not mentioned our program at all. This is the geriatric program. It's a program of four units that's viable, successful, well-known, and actually very well-respected in the state. I'd like to tell you about the geriatric program by sharing with you what I tell families as part of my job on the outreach team is to do coordination of admissions and also do consultation education out in the community. I tell families coming in, they're scared because their elder or younger person who has significant nursing care needs is coming into the state hospital, and they've heard all the horror stories. They've seen the pictures in the Oregonian, and they're very upset. They've gone through a lot with acute psychiatric care for their elder. So I tell them that our units are old, our building is old, but we have very good staff. We have excellent psychiatrists and internists, excellent nurses, and mental health therapists. They're very experienced to deal with the mentally ill elder and people with dementia. I tell them that our plan is always to have that patient discharged into the community because we are a treatment facility. We are not a warehouse. We're not just a place to put someone. And most of our patients are discharged. We average between 80 to 90 patients admitted, and we also discharged probably last year or so in the 70s, 75, 77 patients. So where did these patients go when they're discharged? Okay. We have in the community mental health enhanced care facilities, which is a combination of nursing facilities and residential care facilities that have mental health community program staff that work in those facilities. There are nine units throughout the state. We have nursing facilities, residential care facilities, assisted living facility and nursing homes, and adult foster homes where patients go. They go to regular nursing homes. They also go to live with their families if they had been living with their family before. Sometimes they go to their own home. So we are a treatment facility. We have difficulty in the community placing our patients at times because of the stigma of having been in the state hospital. But we have very good facilities in the enhanced care facilities. The unfortunate thing is that we don't have enough of those facilities. I've been on the planning for possible closure of three of the Jarrow units, and we are looking at what our patients need. And actually, the ideal thing is to have those units without the closure of the geriatric program, because those are what's needed. We have people waiting in the hospital to get some of those beds.
Mr. Chair, may I ask you a question?
Representative Tomei.
Yes.
I'm not familiar with this term, geriatric.
So would most of these people have Alzheimer's?
I would say about half of our patients in the geriatric program have some kind of dementia. Some of it is, most of it is Alzheimer's. Some of it is vascular dementia. Some of it, the dementia types are traumatic brain injury or anoxic brain injury. That's the minority. But probably half of our patients.
Those two again, please.
Traumatic brain injury and anoxic brain injury or lack of oxygen, which causes brain damage.
So for many of these people, it sounds like this is, they're not going to, for many of them, they won't be getting well. They're going to be getting worse.
That's correct.
Possibly worse.
That's correct. They're usually, with Alzheimer's, as you know, I know you had a special hearing on Alzheimer's disease, is a progressive disease. Some of the other dementias, like people who have brain injury, traumatic brain injury, is usually a static for many years. So most of these patients do not get well. They get worse. With dementia, many of our mentally ill patients, however, get better and become go out back out into the community. But we find places in the nursing homes for our dementia patients. And
so they go to a nursing home. For many of these who have Alzheimer's, and they're going to get progressively worse, and they tend to wander and have other kinds of problems. So it seems to me that they need to cure. Place
yes.
A regular foster home, an adult foster home, a regular nursing home probably couldn't be able to facilitate that. Is that correct?
Well, the locked Alzheimer's units can facilitate that. Adult foster homes generally cannot. And the residential care facilities who are specializing in Alzheimer's disease are also locked.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Could you clarify something for me while we're paused? You were describing, John, a situation where you are able to discharge some of the folks out of the Gero psychiatric facility. They come in for a short period of time, and then they're discharged. Why are they being discharged? I mean, are you stabilizing them? Are
we're
you
stabilizing
beds
them,
for
yes.
Them?
Over.
How does that work?
That's a piece. That's sort of an important piece. Yes, we do stabilize them. I mean, we have patients who come in who have bipolar illness and who are manic, who then we stabilize them on their medication. And then they go back out to the community into possibly their own home if they've come from there, or probably out to enhanced care facility who have the mental health staff there in a residential care or a nursing home.
But why are they getting to a point where they need to come into that unit at the hospital? I mean, I would think as an older patient, which is what the Gero means, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably not something new. So they.
That's correct.
So you understand what I'm saying?
You're asking why are they getting to the hospital?
Yeah. Why are they getting there so late? I guess.
Well, as you know, schizophrenia and bipolar illness is a lifelong illness, and therefore people relapse. People get worse. When people get older, they have many complicating issues, medical problems. People get illnesses that cause them, their mental illness, to get worse. So they do have times when they do relapse and become manic or become depressed or become more psychotic with their schizophrenia. And they have behaviors that will send them back into the acute psychiatric units, such as violence, perhaps. They may be found in the Bi-Mart parking lot acting very strangely or very confused, or they may be found in their apartment not been coming out for 3 weeks at a time, or for the last 3 weeks, and they come back. And so the apartment manager calls someone in Portland and says, this man, something's wrong. And he's, you know, in his 60s. And so when people get older, their medical issues and their psychiatric issues go hand in hand. They may have kidney problems, they may have liver problems, they may have heart failure. And anytime any of those get worse, they can also get their mental illness may get worse. And the other issue is dementia, where people become who have Alzheimer's disease. What happens is they may become, for whatever reason, more confused and become violent. And that can be caused by even a urinary tract infection. So they become, I mean, they may choke, try to choke a staff member, or they may become very violent when they're getting a bath or something like that. Or they may, we've had one patient try to put a pillow over another patient's face. Well, you can't, they're dangerous to themselves or others. That's the underlying criteria to get into even the geropsychiatric units.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
That's a long-winded answer. As I mentioned, well, I think I've answered, so I've sort of continued my my testimony by answering that question. But as Laurie said, actually, the Oregon State Hospital is a safety net for elderly and physically disabled in the state. So when the facilities in the community can't care for the patient, they go to acute psych units. And then if they need longer-term care, which is usually like 2 weeks or more, they come to Oregon State Hospital if they meet that criteria for being dangerous to self or others. What happens in the community, in the nursing homes, we need gero specialists out there. These are people who are mental health clinicians who actually have more training in geriatrics or caring for the elderly or physically disabled. We don't have enough of those people out in the community, and that's a lot of the reason, or part of the reason, why we can't, why people get hospitalized also. There are not enough people who know, who can understand the medical issues and the psychiatric issues. So we need more of those, especially in the rural areas. So the question arises, do we need fewer geriatric beds at Oregon State Hospital? Well, only if we want to ignore the demographics, which I'm sure you know about, that we have longer living elderly and that more people are moving into the state, including the elderly. We can close beds only if we have specialty units that can provide expertise and staffing, that can maintain or provide the same quality of life, and that can maintain stability and prevent transfer from one facility to another in the community. Also, we need those facilities to prevent relapse and to prevent future hospitalizations. Community units are not necessarily less expensive than Oregon State Hospital. Financial expediency cannot be the bottom line for closure of geriatric beds at Oregon State Hospital, because surely in the long run it will cost more in personal distress, suffering, and money. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. Hello.
Hello. My name is Lana Chase. I've been a nurse at the state hospital for going on 10 years. I was asked to come here and talk to you all about some of the thoughts I've had over the years. So I'll just start from the top. I think one of the biggest issues is really there's not much connection between the Oregon State Hospital, the community, and the counties. We don't communicate with these people for follow-up care. Sometimes we do a lot of redundant procedures because we don't get the information from these places that have already done testing. It would be nice to have a more efficient liaison between these, since we're dealing with the community and the jails on a daily basis. I currently work with a 370 population, which are individuals who have been deemed unable to aid and assist. And we see quite a cycle with these guys, a lot of what we call frequent flyers, which cost the state a tremendous amount of money. Basically, the way the cycle goes is these people get arrested, they go to jail, the judge deems them unable to aid and assist. They come to us. We have to do what we call outside consults to be able to give them medication to get them stabilized, which that is a rather costly thing. We get them stabilized. They pass what we call an evaluation to go back to court to proceed with their court or the charges against them. Before they get there, though, once they go back to jail, they stop taking their medications because the jail does not force medications like OSH is able to do. So normally, a lot of times, we get these guys back within a short period of time before their court date even comes up. They come right back to the state hospital. That cycle, I've had patients who have been through that cycle up to 3-4 times before they've actually made it to court to deal with the charges against them. And when they do come back to the hospital, we have to do another outside consult in order to give them medications again, which sometimes it hasn't even been a 3-month period of time. It would be nice if the jails could have some kind of policies to where they could force medications on to mentally ill people to take the medications as we can do. I think that would significantly save the state, counties, lots of money. I hear a lot of people talking today about what we all can do for the mentally ill people, and having worked with them for almost 10 years now, it seems like that maybe we need to find a way to get them to take a little bit more responsibility in managing their own mental illness. A lot of the patients we get through, they don't want to take meds. They don't like the side effects. They don't want to pay for them. They don't want to deal with it. Good portion of these people collect SSI. They tap into all the resources possible, yet they still are non-med compliant, which is what brings them usually back to the state hospital in the first place. It would just be nice to see them take a little bit more responsibility for their own illness if they're capable, and a lot of them are capable. They just choose to use substances instead of taking the prescribed medications. The need for the state hospital, I think that's pretty simple. The community needs to know that they're safe from these dangerous people, and the mentally ill people need a safe place to go to get treatment. Another big issue that we have, we get patients stabilized on medications, and we actually have we're handed out a form from the pharmacies on what medications we can discharge patients to certain counties on. So if we get them stabilized on one antipsychotic, there's a good chance as soon as they get back out in the community, that's going to be changed because it's too expensive. So usually what happens, they'll decomp and end up back in the hospital. There is lots of changes that could be made at the hospital. I think the big one, that patients should have an Access 1 diagnosis. I think as Joe was talking earlier, we get a lot of people who strictly are what we call Access 2. They're substance abuse and personality disorders. You know, I'm not a correctional nurse. I'm not trained to deal with correctional type people.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Even with a degree in psychology, I'm a little at loss for some of the acronyms that you are throwing around.
Such as?
Access 1, Access 2.
An Access 1 diagnosis is a major mental. That's somebody, you know. That's what the DSMR classifies as a major mental illness. Usually that's like your schizophrenia, bipolar, schizoaffective, major depressive disorders. Access 2 is more your substance abuse and your personality, borderline, antisocial, criminal type.
Follow up, Mr. Chief.
Follow up.
Are you saying personality disorders are not a mental illness?
I think depending on what the personality disorder is, I've seen at the hospital over the years lots of individuals who, well, I have patients right now who have very significant rap sheets. They don't always have, they don't have Access 1 diagnoses. We don't prescribe them meds, yet we end up treating them sometimes for a very significant period of time. I just think that it's inappropriate to, you know, those individuals to come to us. I think some personality disorders would definitely, if they're a danger to themselves, which some of the access to personality disorders can be, would be appropriate. But I don't think that people who have spent a lot of time in the criminal system and who, you know, get high on some meth and do something really crazy and then they come and end up with us for a significant period of time is appropriate.
Okay.
Did you have a couple final thoughts?
No.
Okay. All right, Lana, thank you very much. And I suppose you're Marilyn?
I'm Marilyn.
Marilyn Gordon, welcome.
Thank you.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I've been a nurse at Oregon State Hospital for the past 3 years. I've had 30 years of mental health experience. And I'm here today because of my mental health therapist mainly and because of my co-RNs, but mainly the mental health therapist which I deal with. You have in your packet that Joe Thurman gave you the very last section. One of my mental health therapists prepared this, and I would really like you to take a look at it because this is why I'm here today.
Is that the Mary Foley piece?
It starts at the top. Please note when referring to a patient, writer has abbreviated using patient's name or number.
Oh.
It's this one.
Yeah.
It's a very... It was in Joe Thurman's packet.
Yeah, there's quite a few things. Yeah. Just please note. Okay.
Yes.
It's about midway through college.
That's the one that I am here for today, and that's the one I would like to take have you take a look at with me.
Okay.
And then go through the scenario. Now, I work...
Can we do that in about 5 minutes?
We can do it in 5 minutes.
Okay.
And Ms. Lana, I would like... would have liked you up here. And she disappeared on me.
Oh.
I work on the maximum security, which is the 370 admission ward. And below maximum security 48C is 48B. And I've highlighted a couple of these that I wanted you to take particular attention to. On the first page, we have patient in seclusion, busted toilet seat, cut on self, and threatened staff. We have patient attempted to hang self while on toilet, fought with staff.
Okay, where are you?
I'm on the first page, and I'm just kind of reading down and summarizing the main highlights that I could see were the most significant.
Yeah, I got you. I got you.
Okay.
And wait, let's slow down for a second. So you work on 48C?
I work on 48C.
Which is the maximum security
right,
ward.
Right, the maximum security admission ward.
Admission ward. And what, you said something about 48B?
48B is where they come back after they're under the PSRB, the maximum security.
Okay. That's separate. 48C, I assume, is a forensics ward?
48C is forensic. 48B is forensic. They both are.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Joe, do you have something?
I just came for moral support.
Okay. We're all friends
up here.
We've seen you before. That's all right. Go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to hit some of the highlights of these, and I'd like to make a comment that my mental health therapists that have been on this page are pretty much the ones that are here today.
Okay.
Patient seclusion, busted toilet seat, cut on self, threatened staff. Patient attempted to hang self while on toilet, fought with staff while they were trying to help him. Cup of urine and excretion thrown on him head at the end of the shift. Now this person that this was thrown on, it was dripping off of him. He was totally covered from head to foot. In the prison system, you can press charges. In a mental health system, you cannot press charges. And this person is here today, it was in his mouth, it was in his eyes, it was totally all over. The next patient, another cup of urine and feces thrown on. Patient wanting to go to seclusion and restraint, so he hit staff member in the face. A female staff member assaulted by patient with water pitcher while she was given medications, this was.
Can I ask you to, read the dates out as you're going down?
Oh, I'm on 3304.
Okay.
And this one, she was hit 15 to 20 times. She's left bruised and battered. They had her down on the ground. On 315, one staff member was punched in the face, a chokehold around his neck. Another staff member was punched in the head and spit on. On 321, this was during a group, during rec therapy group, a patient came up behind a staff member, what the patient had done was torn the bottom of his shirt off and used it as a rope, put it around the staff member's neck, and tried to choke him, to the point that the staff member had red marks all around his neck and almost killed him. Took another patient to help get this staff, this patient off of the other staff member. On 3/26, I'm going to hit someone. I won't hit a patient, but I'll hit a staff, and that's okay because they get paid to get hit. On 4/1, patient ran up to staff, took off his shoes, and threatened to use as a weapon, and then spit on staff. 4/20, attacked from behind, hit on the head. 5/1, hit and broke glasses, cut on face, went to hospital. 5/5, riot, unit went into lockdown. 5/8, both were hit in the head two times while other staff were down hall trying to deal with a suicide attempt. 5/31, hit in the head two times, had to go to hospital. 7/28, chased down by patient, assaulted several times, sent to ER. 8/9, hit in the face from behind, fractured left cheekbone. Patient's comment was F him. 9/3, the doctor, this was on doctor, our physician on the ward. Patient climbed over partition in an attempt to attack doctor. Line staff was able to stop him. 9/24, patient walked up to staff, hit him several times, both eyes blackened. Patient said he wanted to get out. 10/15, patient was taking meds, didn't like meds, hit staff in the face. 10/20, patient broke toilet seat in the side room, used it as a weapon. Patient hit the staff member over the face and the head. 10/28, two female staff had hair pulled, pinched, and kicked in the face. 11/8, a patient had the staff member's hair wrapped in his fist, then was hitting her head against a metal door. Took 5 minutes to free herself and get other staff assistance.
Was that a male patient or a female patient?
It was a male. 48C is all male patients, female staff member. I'm going to skip over to 12/21 because I know we are late. This is the staff member that in December was on the news. Viciously attacked, broke nose, crushed cheekbones, inflamed vertebrae, spinal damage, cut to the eye, and much, much more. She is still recovering. She was kicked several times after being beaten and kicked to the floor. She is still off working in therapy 3 days a week. The other staff members were dealing with the situation down the hall when this happened. What I would like to say regarding all of these incidences is when the staff members are involved in these type of situations, if they are assaulted badly enough that they need to go to the hospital, we have to provide our own transportation, or we have to find a staff member that's on break, or we have to call a family member or get another family member's friends to come and help us.
You can't call 911?
If it's bad enough, we can call 911, but then it's... our insurance would pay for it. So if there's extra charges, we would pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we have to sign off on our timesheet. Like, say the incident happened at 2, and we go to the hospital, and we're there till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. We don't get paid to sit in the ER. If we have to take time off because we're on light duty, that's our time.
The other thing is that there's no counseling, no trauma response team or anything at the state hospital to help staff members when they are traumatized. And that's something that we've been pushing for since 2001 with the old administration. Now, the new administration is listening to us on this, but still there's not been any movement on it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Aren't you able to access the employee assistance program too?
We are, but generally, and I just went to a conference on PTSD and stress management. Generally, when you're in those circumstances, you're not thinking real clearly, and it's put upon you to contact them on your own. Nobody really contacts them for you.
What about your supervisors?
Well, on swing shift, if it happens, first off, there are no supervisors, and they aren't there. quite frankly. So you're basically on your own to contact them. And at that point, right after a trauma, you're not thinking real clearly, and you may not want that. What you really need at that point is to vent and to be able to leave the unit and probably go home for a while and just be able to vent like that. But what we find is we're so short-staffed that you can't go home because there are not enough staff to replace you. I mean, we're running a bare-bones staffing.
We're going to have to come back to that. And I think I've got a videotape of our hearing. We're going to sit through the videotape and sort of present a list of questions and try to get some more answers in depth. But we're already about 10 minutes over time, and I still want to get to everybody and still be respectful of everybody's time in the room. So, Representative Anderson, did you have a comment you wanted to make?
Well, I've got a lot of questions.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we could at some point get a compendium of some of the answers to these difficult situations. What you'd like to see done? What actions would really pinpoint some of the preliminary changes?
Well, I think that, for, like I said in my statement earlier, I think that we need a corrections-type security team at the state hospital. I don't want
Mr. Thurman, we don't need to go in with the recommendations now. I think Representative Anderson is asking you to come up with some suggestions. So I invite.
Another question I did have, though, is some of these aggressive acts. Is there a lockdown for people like that, or how do you?
There's seclusion and restraint.
Okay.
So you can do that.
After the effect.
Right. But yeah. It's nursing staff that have to institute it and have to perform the act.
One final question.
Yeah.
How many situations do we have where we have female nurses working on an all-male floor? Or?
Oh, a lot. A lot. A lot of times there's over 50% of the staff are female on an all-male ward.
Yeah, Representative Anderson, I think what happens in your lockdown question is if there's an incident, they call on staff. At least it's been explained to me by some staff while I've been out there on tour that they call other staff. But oftentimes there isn't anybody on the ward to come and help you. They have to come from other buildings. They have to come from other locations. And it's, I imagine, a harried few minutes or more before you get some help. So this is a huge issue that we have to sort of take up. Thank you very much for bringing it to our attention. I think this is awful what you're describing. I have to take some time to digest exactly what's going on in these comments. So.
Mr. Chairman, please look at the suggestions that our staff have made here is that we have a trauma response team, that we have a security team, and I will make that short. But
okay.
We need, you know, EAP, I've been there 4 years, and in answer to your EAP question, I've never seen them. I've had the supervisors call 2 times, and they come for a very brief time and don't come when the people that have been in the incident are involved. So EAP has been very ineffective.
And, Chairman, that data is in my packet, actually.
Okay.
That she was describing.
I'll look to it. Thank you, Mr. Thurman. Thank you, Marilyn, very much. All right. That concludes the AFSCME panel. We have 4 or 5 folks signed up from the SEIU panel. So I'll invite Daniel Smith, Jackie Pierce, and Louis Cronenberg, is it? Cronenberg. And Randy, are you on another list or?
No, I didn't sign up today.
Okay.
All right.
You did.
Okay.
He made you.
All right.
He made me.
All right. Well, you know, I saw you over there.
Thanks for that trip.
Sure. And I don't want to shortchange the folks who haven't gotten a chance to speak, but if we go very much longer, we're going to start losing committee members, so additional committee members. So if we can do the best we can to make our points as direct as possible, it'd be great. We have some materials. Okay, who would like to? Jackie, you'd like to go first,
yeah.
Or Daniel? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chairman Dalto and respected members of the committee, thank you for having us, and thank you very much for listening to the voices of the workers at Oregon State Hospital. I realize that you've been listening to a number of different thoughts and opinions about the future of the hospital throughout the week, let alone today. I have some prepared statements, but I will shorten them and send them to you separately. What I'd like to say is that I'm a psychologist resident. I'm at the Oregon State Hospital. I've been there almost 2 years. Prior to coming here, I worked in community mental health in Arizona and in Wisconsin. I also worked in the Wisconsin State Hospital prior to coming here.
Dan, can I get you to just say your name for the record? I think I've been lax on that, but everybody needs to say their name so that we have it on the tape. Okay.
Yes, Chairman Dalto. I'm Daniel Smith, Dr. Daniel Smith, psychologist resident at the Oregon State Hospital.
Thank you.
Oregon State Hospital is not Cuckoo's Nest. It's not the place that Ken Kesey wrote about and Jack Nicholson portrayed in a movie. And it's not the horrible torture chamber that the Oregonian makes it out to be. What it is a home for the sickest people, the most mentally ill people in the state of Oregon. And we're the people that work with them every single day. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, we're there meeting their needs. Roughly, depending on whose figures you look at, 20 to 30% of the population of the United States suffers a mental illness at some time. Our hospital treats the sickest 1% of that group, the people with the most chronic and profound mental illnesses, people who are unable to be safe for themselves, unable to be safe with others. The hospital is changing, and the role of the hospital is changing, but Oregon has created a safety net where everybody who doesn't fit anywhere else goes. And that's the Oregon State Hospital. That's why we have so many different missions. That's why we have so many different roles. We have forensic units where mentally ill criminals are held. And within the forensic department, we have evaluation services that make determinations about whether or not people can effectively work with their attorneys to defend themselves. And if they cannot, we provide education and medication in hopes that they will be able to assist their attorneys and defend themselves in court. We also have civil commitment units, units where men and women who are unable to function safely in the community live. People who, for reasons that are not always clear, are unable to not harm themselves or not harm others. We also have geropsychiatric units, units for people who have advanced dementia or brain injury to the point where they cannot function. And the reason that they're at the hospital is because they don't fit in the community. They don't fit in community placements because they're dangerous. Some of them mean to be, some of them do not mean to be, but all of them are. And we deal with that daily. We deal with that on every unit, not just the one unit that you received the description of. I've turned over some materials. One of them is another copy of the list that you've already received about the incidents on one unit. Another are five principles of mental health care reform that a number of our residents, or excuse me, not our residents, but our employees have signed. Those are the purple forms. And those five principles are basically that there needs to be change, that the safety net needs to continue, the community placement can be an effective alternative, that collaboration is necessary, and that our mental health system is in crisis. What we believe as the staff is that the most important thing is to make sure that our residents, our clients, are safe and that they have as good a life as they possibly can. Because of that, we're already putting into place sanctuary models very similar to what you heard discussed earlier at Eastern Oregon. There are many changes that are taking place with the new administration at the hospital, changes that we welcome. One of the things that I very much want to point out is that we're understaffed, that there have been a number of openings that have not been filled on our regular staff, and our line staff are routinely mandated, meaning that they finish their 8-hour shift and then they are told they must work another 8-hour shift, despite the fact that they may have a little league game to go to, maybe they have to pick up their children or take care of child care, or maybe they're working from a swing shift which begins at 2:30 in the afternoon clear until 6 a.m. the next morning if they're mandated to work the nights as well. It's because we don't have enough positions filled that this happens. That leads to a lot of problems with overtime, which increases our budget. If we filled all of the empty positions, then we would take care of some of the strain on our budget. Our physical plant needs work. Too often money has been spent to redecorate, to fix, to patch, to get by. The computer system that they described to you, I don't know if any of you remember the Commodore 64. That's the AS400. It's roughly equivalent. We are only now beginning to get PCs, and we hope to have them throughout the hospital, I think they said, by the end of April. Only now. We need a lot of things. But you've got one of the best, most dedicated staffs in the entire country. People who show up to work even though they've been beaten the day before, or somebody's thrown feces on them, or they've just faced vile abuse from people who don't have any ability not to be abusive. They still go back and they still do a great job, but they're underpaid and they're not given the respect that they deserve. I could probably talk for another 2 or 3 hours. My guess is your ears are about ready to fall off. I'll just point out we've made a list of points that we'd like to refer to you, and that's been handed out. I'm going to hand this over now to Luke Kronenberg. Yes, that's that list.
Okay. Chairman Dalto, committee, I'm going to shorten my speech a little bit because I know we're running out of time here, so bear with me. Let's face it, taking care of people with mental illness is no easy job. Last year alone, on a maximum security unit that you've heard about today, there were 116 injuries. The copy that you got, I want you to know, that is one unit that houses 32 gentlemen. 116 injuries in 1 year. Many of those cases, like you heard, those folks were sent to the ER. A lot of times they had to find their own transportation. Under the new administration, they're working on making that available for us, and we appreciate that. In the future, I would hope that these things would become avoidable. But unless we get more staff, less mandated overtime, and more training, and a team approach to these things, I don't see it happening. I'm glad there's attention finally being drawn to our hospital. It's been needed for a long time, as Senator Courtney has said. Corrections has been in the limelight for many years, since the mid-80s. It's our time to come into the limelight. I hope that you folks, when you read the paper, don't have knee-jerk reactions to the things you're reading in that paper and not believe everything that you read. I work with many dedicated people every day that, like the doctor says, take beatings and come back every day and do a darn good job. Recently, we had a ceremony at the hospital for one of our coworkers who had passed away. We had a patient stand up and said that this gentleman was the father that he never had. That's impressive. So I want you to know that we're not all thugs and we're not all bullies, and we are caring people. As you know, our census has risen. Since I've been there in the last 10 years, our census has risen to 739 from the 410 when I started there. We're still working with generally the same group of staff. It has increased a little bit, but not nearly enough. Like I said, the state has hired some of the finest people I've worked with and got to know in my 10 years there. At this time, we have wards at the hospital that at times we have two or three staff members on these large units with long hallways. This goes on for several hours during a shift that you may be up there being the caretaker or the peacekeeper for 30 to 40 individuals, 45 at some times. Not to mention our patients are in rooms that were designed to be for 3 to 4 patients. Some have 5, 6, even up to 7 patients in those rooms. It's not acceptable. Many times our staff members do not have the time to sit down and do a one-to-one with patients that desperately need the one-to-one to stop some sort of behavior from occurring. And those reasons are because we don't have enough staff to carry out our daily duties, which could be anywhere from dealing with medications to giving meals, to setting up meals for 40 gentlemen, to running recreational activities, to being security, since we have no real security at our hospital. Many times I'm asked to put hands on a patient. I've spent months building a therapeutic alliance with this patient so he trusts me. And then I'm asked to go and wrestle him to the ground and put him in straps. Worse, I lose my therapeutic alliance with that patient. There's no more trust there. Historically, when our numbers are down to two or three people on a unit, that's the worst time for us. Those are where the worst things have happened on our units. But all the staff of the Oregon State Hospital, every day they come in, their number one goal is security and safety, and they do a good job of that. Our hospital, recently we found that we have, even with all the assaults and the attacks and everything that goes on, we have a seclusion and restraint level that is lower than the national average. So what that tells me is that we do a very good job of stepping out in front and working with these folks before they have a chance to blow up and really go catastrophic on us. So in closing, I'd like to say, if our hospital has a future, and I hope it does, because we, like many of my colleagues have said, we need a safety net for these folks, these dangerous, very dangerous folks, that we are a part of that, and we are a part of that future and helping decide where we go. And I want to thank you for your time.
Thanks very much, Representative Boone.
Maybe Deputy Superintendent Maynard, I can't remember your last name, I'm sorry. Maybe you can assure me that when the employees are injured, they can call 911 like everyone else can and be afforded the treatment of the fire department and be taken to the local emergency department if that's where they need to go, and not have to drive injured or scared or traumatized, because I think that's a danger in itself.
Representative Booth, can we maybe take that offline just so I can get everybody, and then we'll come back to it with all due respect.
For later then.
Yeah, thank you. Let's just finish up. I wanted to talk to you just a moment and let you know. You know, I remember as a staff person in 2001 session, I worked for a person named Jackie Winters, and she. I often tell people, you know, who are wondering why I'm so passionate about human services, I explain to her people that she opened my eyes to this world that I didn't know existed, which was the things that you do, the things a lot of people do to make sure that people who need our help are protected. And I can remember Mary Botkin, meeting Mary. You can't forget Mary, you know. She's a wonderful person, a good friend of mine. And Mary used to come in and just look at me and say, look, our people over at the state hospital are getting this stuff kicked out of them. They're getting beat up. What are we doing about this? Here's my plan. She's been trying. She's been working. Your colleagues have been working to sort of develop this issue as far as sort of my worldview in the legislature has been the past 4 years now. But sometimes these issues, I guess, just take a lot of time and a lot of people coming together to be able to make them as important as they need to be like this. And so I'm struck by what you reported President Courtney as having said, that, you know, we put a lot of attention on the correction system for a long time, and it's now time for the state hospital. You're right. I mean, it makes me crazy every time I read an article about the state hospital, because I've been there. I've talked to some of your colleagues, and I know what's going on. I know how hard you're working, and I know, you know, the people are in a really difficult situation. But it isn't falling apart. It's, you know, there's a lot of challenges, a lot of shortfalls, and we're all trying to sort of work on it. And that's what my hope is for our process here, is to get everybody's story, everybody's information. The Ways and Means folks, they're down there crunching numbers, and they have like this much time to, you know, think about the real stories, you know, and mostly it's just a spreadsheet and figuring out, you know, will this work, will this balance? And that's what we're trying to do, is to get as much information as possible, so when this draft report comes out, or even before it comes out, we can sort of steer this thing in a certain way to make sure that you guys have a voice, everybody has a voice to make this thing better. So your words couldn't be more meaningful, and I really appreciate your hear.
Well, Chairman Dalto, I'd like to thank our new administration, too, for allowing us to, you know, the attorney that spoke earlier, I forget his name, talked about our spirit and taking our jobs as ho-hum. That offends me. we're some of the most spirited people you'd ever want to be around, and some of the most caring people you'd ever want to be around. I look forward to coming to work every day, even in those days when I can hardly get out of bed because the bones hurt from all the physical management I've done.
Even on this list that we went through?
Even. I'm on those lists, sir, and I still look forward to coming to work at OSH every day and doing my job, and that's because of the people I work with and the patients that I work with. So, and with the new administration, I got the chance this first time this year to take a patient out for a walk on the grounds, actually several patients. In my 10-year, I've never done that, and I'm doing other things, taking patients to see their families, taking patients to funerals, to birthday parties, to be back together with their family. We wouldn't have done that under the old administration. We're getting the chance to do that. So when the lawyer talks about spirited,
yeah.
Right, I mean, give us a chance. Give the new administration a chance. I think things are changing. I think they're going to get better. I think it's just going to take some time. And I think the folks that are working there now are some of the best people to turn that place around that you could ask for.
I think he's on your side.
I think so.
And you certainly have the commitment of this panel, our time and our talents to put this thing back together and move forward for you. We're working for you, so.
It's good to hear that.
Thanks. That's why we did this at night here, so your colleagues that are working, they could come in and come on in. All right, thanks very much. Jackie.
Thank you.
Okay. I know, my name is Jackie Pearson. I know you're going to hear the same thing probably from me that you've heard from everybody else because there's really not much left. But I'm going to say my piece anyway, seeing as I took a long time to sit and write it out, so. I'm sorry it's going to take another few minutes.
Go ahead,
here.
Jackie.
Okay.
No problem.
My name is Jackie Pierce. I am a psychiatric social worker at Oregon State Hospital. I started there in 1989 in the forensics program, and then in 1997 I transferred over to the geriatric psychiatric program in geriatrics. The program consists of four wards. There's a medical unit, there's a head injury ward, and the two other wards which have long-term mentally ill, elderly long-term mentally ill, and people with Alzheimer's or dementia disorders. I currently work on 34D, which is an all-male ward with 29 patients. My patients' ages range from 53 years to 87 years of age. Half of the patients have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or some other type of dementia. The remainder of my patients have various psychiatric disorders, which includes bipolar disorders, depression, schizophrenia, and schizoaffective disorder. The patient population also includes patients with drug and alcohol problems, sex offenders, and developmentally disabled patients, or a combination of all the above. So they can have drug and alcohol, they can be developmentally disabled, and have a mental illness on top of it. We have 6 patients on my unit who are under psychiatric security review board, 10 civilly committed patients, and 13 placed there by their guardians. The majority of my patients need total care by staff, and the rest of them need some type of assistance. Most of my patients have been referred to Oregon State Hospital because of aggressive behaviors, inappropriate sexual behaviors, or intrusiveness to both peers and staff, either in a nursing home, an assisted living facility, hospitals in the community, or in the patient's own home. But what I'm really here to talk about is the difficulty that the social workers in my program have had in getting our patients placed back in the community when they are ready for discharge. I have a patient that's been ready for discharge since December. He has dementia. He's got Alzheimer's disease. But he's not been accepted because of his aggressive history. Prior to coming to the hospital, he hit a patient while living in a nursing home, knocked the resident down. The person hit his head and died. There isn't a nursing home out in the community that will take that liability again for their other patients or other residents. So here I have a patient that currently sits there, basically can get up, walk around. But 2 nursing homes at this point have already rejected him because of that history. I just had a patient admitted from an assisted living facility because he put a pillow over another resident's face. He just came in yesterday. He also hit a nurse in the face while at the Johnson's unit in the Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. She ended up in the emergency room. This patient will be a difficult patient to place when the time comes. I was also in the process of placing another one of my patients who was accepted in an assisted living facility up in Hood River. We went up there on last Friday for us to see the facility, for them to assess him. Basically, he was accepted. You know, they gave him the grand tour, they showed him his room, they interviewed him, and then today I got a phone call saying the corporation does not accept patients who have mental illnesses because they do not know how to deal with them. So I've yet to have to tell this patient that this placement probably will not work out, even though I had set up wraparound mental health services from the community mental health program up in Hood River. They were going to go show up every day and provide services. This facility said no, that they no longer could take him. Other reasons our patients have not been accepted into placements, and I'm just not talking about patients on my unit, I'm talking about throughout the whole geriatrics program, is if it takes two or more staff to do cares on them, they won't take him. If the patients continue to be aggressive, hit out, they won't take him in a nursing home or another type of assisted living facility. They're nervous about the past psychiatric disorders or their physical aggression. Or if it's been inappropriate sexual behaviors, they'll have difficulty placing them. Other reasons that we've had difficulty is because the criteria for senior and people with disabilities criteria has gotten much stricter as to who they are going to take. And so places that we normally could place people in that they cover, we can't place people into those facilities because they say our patients are not appropriate for those placements. Our patients are also sent back to the hospital, contrary to maybe what you heard earlier. We do have patients that come back to the hospital. A patient came back today from a facility out in Silverton. She was brought back because she bed hops. She's basically a dementia patient. She goes from bed to bed, whether somebody's in the bed or somebody's not in the bed. She goes and lays down in somebody else's bed. They knew that when they took her and when they accepted her. She went out on March the 7th. It is now March the 16th. They sent her back today and said, we can't provide services for her. She's too intrusive to other patients. Other patients have come back because they become too psychotic for the facility to handle it. One of my patients who went out back in beginning of December basically became so paranoid. The doctor had changed his med. The doctor in the facility had added a medication, added an antidepressant to his scheduled med, and he became extremely psychotic, and he wanted to have other residents and the staff cut his arms and legs off, asked them to crucify him, went outside without his shirt on, yelling to be crucified and to cut off his arms and legs. They wanted to basically keep him in the facility, but it was too disruptive to the rest of the residents in that placement. And that placement is an enhanced care placement that basically is set up to take patients with psychiatric disorders. Okay, so they normally know how to deal with those patients. This patient, they finally said, we can't deal with him. This is just kind of a tip of the iceberg of why some of our patients can't get placed in the community and why they ended up coming back to the state hospital. Our elderly patients, I believe, are the most vulnerable patients out there. It is up to each and every one of us to make sure that they are provided mental health and medical services and care in a safe, secure, and caring environment. The geriatrics programs and the staff at Oregon State Hospital provide that. Without that safety net of OSH, what will happen to our patients when the community placements fail and there is no geriatrics program to send them back to? Will they end up on the streets? That's my question to you. So thank you very much, Chairman Dalto and the rest of the committee.
Thanks, Jackie. Thanks to all of you. Great job. Great job. Wish we had some more time. All right. Is Jim Hugg still here?
No, he had to leave.
He had to leave. Okay. And so did Bob Jundep. So was there anybody that we missed? Anybody wishing to testify that wasn't called up? Okay. All right. Well, first of all, colleagues, thanks very much for taking this time with us. I really appreciate you being here. It's something that's very important to me, and I know it's to each and every one of you, so we want to make sure everybody has an opportunity to share with us what they need to share with us. We're going to take some time with all the testimony today and sort of go over it, and my intention will be to go over my 8 pages of notes and work with the department and the hospital administration to get some more information on some of the points that were brought up. And thank you, all of you, for staying. Probably past the dinner hour, but we appreciate you. We'll wrap this up on Friday, but if there's something that you didn't have a chance to say, or if there's something that a colleague of yours would like to offer, we'll keep our public testimony record open, so you're welcome to get more information to us, and we'll incorporate it. So with that, we will adjourn this meeting. Have a good night.